Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. This is our post-eclipse show. Ooh, to translate the light of this powerful event. Ooh, and a shout out to my fantabulous hosts in Lampasas, Texas, guiding us to the perfect spot, the Pupori clan. Thank you. Mutual aid, great teamwork, wonderful, mini communities, larger communities. So the moon today, is its image, is Radical Magazine spiraling forth liberating ideas. And we go, okay, anarcho-entheo-astro-animism, we welcome the return of Eddie Nix, who, according to his bio, plays a bookseller in real life and has many projects operating in the dream world. He is founder and operator of Driftless Books and Music in Viroqua, Wisconsin. It's a mecca for people come from all over. It's fantastic. And was a founding teacher at Youth Initiative High School, where he taught anarchism, we're going to get there, and has a radio show on community radio station WDRT. Yes, wonderful, every Sunday. He identifies as a rhizome or a verb, depending on circumstances. He has been many other things also. So we're really thinking of this as part one, because the material is so rich, and I'm going to base my Mayday Beltane to the Summer Solstice Council on it, too, because it's like, oh. So we aspire to just proffer, you know, resources. So, post-eclipse magic, honoring ancestral mentors, David Graeber, Peter Lamborn Wilson, Kropotkin, the anomalous egalitarian city of Teotihuacan, which I learned about in David Graeber's fantastic, fantastic book, The Dawn of Everything. Oh, so good. And the living mentors, Isabel Wilkerson, author of Caste, The Origins of Our Discontent, the subject of Ava DuVernay's profoundly pertinent movie, Origin. I watched half of it on the plane, and the plane landed too soon. I'm like, no, go back up. I was watching on my phone, got home, watched the whole thing. Cannot recommend it highly enough. You know, it was a 2023 movie. It should have won the everything. Best movie. Wonderful. And anything else to guide us at this decisive time that community eclipse cults. So, welcome, Eddie Nix. Hello? Welcome, Eddie Nix.
Hello. Sorry about that. Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you now.
Yes, the evil mute. It's an honor to be with you and talk to the good people of the Bay Area.
And everywhere. We have listeners in northwestern Canada, and sometimes everywhere around the world. Yeah, equality is our theme. So, I was just reading, perusing, and going back for more on mutual aid. Our friends at PM Publishers, we want to talk about books and the plight of books, who made this beautiful, beautiful copy of Mutual Aid, An Illuminated Factor of Evolution, with the introduction by David Graeber. I hadn't even noticed that, my goodness. So equality. And the reason I wanted to just include, I had not read Caste, but I will now, by Isabel Wilkerson, the movie, so powerful and pertinent, you know, about caste and what it requires, and its dehumanization, and where we'll go across borders, that the Nazis gained great literal guidance from America's treatment of indigenous people and blacks, you know, and then she goes to the Dalit people in India. And her point is, she said, it's not about race, really. It's about caste. And she makes this really great case of, you know, subjugation. So equality and mutual aid is really our sacrament that we're invoking, right?
Yes, always.
Right.
Yeah, what an amazing book, and what an amazing way to think about sort of our problems as we face them today. Sometimes the simple things you want to reach for are no longer there, and you have to, I think, reach for a deeper understanding of some of these issues that the wallpaper slogans don't really take care of.
Oh, what are the wallpaper slogans?
Well, when you're talking, I mean, you know, the entire issue of race, we're so caught up in it, and it's causing so many different polarities and things we hadn't maybe anticipated. Whereas looking at this idea of caste and perhaps looking back to the idea of class, another idea that's been sort of pushed under, you know, the rug, would help us. That's kind of what I was saying.
Yeah, no, it's, and like Graeber's introduction to mutual aid, you know, the tremendous amount of bamboozlement and con that we've all been subject to as conditioning to go, no, this is wrong. And you know, Isabel Wilkerson makes the point and quotes many esteemed, wonderful black women writers saying, no, the colonizers didn't really think that blacks were inferior. Why would you hand the raising of your babies and children to people that you, that was all a fiction. That was all a justifiable fiction, you know, these fictions. But it requires, you know, subjugation. And I think we just want to put some of these concepts on the table of what is a cult? A cult is the toxic mimic of a community, and is where we outsource our autonomy to, well, really to anything, you know. So, yeah, and the cons, and then coming back, and I love following Sim Curran on Instagram too, in which she does many things on Gaza, but says, you know, but really what it comes down to is everyone has equal rights, everyone has a safe place to live, because that's just how it's got to be. I mean, we're just kind of coming back to simple models, and I love translating the light from the eclipse, powerful, powerful event. And it was at 19 degrees of Aries, which is where Peter Lamborn Wilson's moon was at 19 Aries when he was born, full moon guy. Do you want to just honor him? You introduced me to him, and I'm like, oh, a friend I never met, like David Graeber, like a great friend I never met. So anything you want to, by way of introducing Peter Lamborn Wilson to us and what he held most dear.
Yeah, Peter was a fascinating character, and I'd characterize him as, you know, one of the 20th century's most intriguing philosophers. He also wrote under the name Hakim Bey, a classic book back in the 80s called Taz, The Temporary Autonomous Zone, Ontological Anarchy and Poetic Terrorism. You know, in which he tried to reframe some of these arguments of on both the mystical, let's say, occult side of things and the radical anarchist side of things. He, along with his pseudo brother Robert Anton Wilson, who were both dear friends and mentors of mine, you know, really were, I think that was part of their main game, is to bring those two sides, the mystical anarcho-spiritualist syndicate, together. And, you know, without one, you can't understand the other. I think Peter had a great quote, without higher states of consciousness, anarchism ends and dries up into a form of misery, a whining
Ooh.
complaint.
Ooh. Ooh, that's so good. Right. No, that's wonderful. And mentors, you said the magic word, the duck descends, because this eclipse is really the eclipse of returning mentors. We welcome all help and guidance to our rogue species, because the sun, the moon, and Chiron, little planetoid representing the earliest mentor, we're all at 19 Aries, 24 seconds exactly. And we go, ooh, come on back, mentors. Yeah, so when you say that again, mentors, antidote to dementors, models, you know, and people whose work I want to read everything they've ever written now, going, ooh, much, because it's so pertinent, pitching to us. Yeah, and very much, you know, no priesthoods, right? So we can see where it runs into problems. It's like no mediation. But the last show we did out of at Viroqua at adorable WDRT, you know, I wanted to also just sort of, that was so rich. I want to re-listen to that show, because that was a crucial moment of going, I loved, you know, spirituality and the occult and esoterica from childhood on, encountered anarchism, excuse me, was like, yes, 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 yes. And then feeling that anarchism was intrinsically spiritual, because it's when everyone taps in and cultivates their good citizenship, or their intrinsic endogenous mutual aid, you know, it all works out well. And I go, oh, so it is the spiritual form of political engagement. And then to read, you know, the occult roots of anarchism, Erica Lagalais, I think, was one of the books we were honoring in Mutual Aid, going, oh, right, hence happily referring to myself and anybody else who wants as anarcho-entheo-astro-animism. Because one of the things that entheogens do is it removes, well, humans are sneaky. I was going to say it removes priesthood, right, into direct experience, although now that it's a business, there's a lot of mediation going on, you know, but it is unmediated, right? So no priesthood, direct mediation, everybody tapping in, you know, and therefore agreeing, you know, because people are tapping into what's real. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. You mentioned Graver's introduction to the Kropotkin book, Mutual Aid.
Yes.
That BM Press just put out. Yeah, fabulous work. And in that introduction, he you know, in terms of toxic narratives we're all still following, you know, Kropotkin was pushed after, you know, reading Darwin and Spencer, who came up with the idea of survival of the fittest, and it was taken by Darwin and Huxley and these guys, and, you know, it means to justify our imperialist, slave-owning, you know, murdering empire. But Kropotkin said, well, no, I'm gonna study this. And he did his research. He went to Siberia for years and years and studied animals and was like, well, I don't see this. I see cooperation. You know, so he really tried to push back on that narrative of like, it's everyone against everyone, folks. You better, you know, get your guns and load up. I think he was much more into nature. If we're going to model our solutions from nature, is inherently cooperative and not inherently competitive.
Right. And let's go to beauty and Venus and James Hillman, my conversing about the opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. So either we have a living sense of beauty or we're anesthetized and can't have a democracy or anything, right? So no solution without beauty, you know, and then, you know, Enviro corporate consultants always says the ship crossing the ocean, who's in charge? And people go, the captain. He goes, nope, the designer. And all of the major issues we're facing as a crisis are all design issues. Right, and then we backstage we're talking about, you know, well, no rules but guidelines. We want to go back to high schools, and many things are all over the place. But you know, and in Viroqua, what's happening? I mean, Viroqua. I opened my Equinox talk going, Viroqua, a hotbed of antheo anarcho animist, whatever the phrase is, astro animism, and the crowd was like, yes, we are. So that's very darling. And then you were saying backstage, well, we have no models. And I go, nature has the model. And then I referred to the fantastic radio interview I did with Janine Benyus in 2008, but we keep replaying it because it's so wonderful. And she's saying, do you know how bees practice democracy? I'm like, no, tell me. And I so love this, you know, even if we've heard it, we can hear it again and again. She said, when bees need to move, when the community needs to move, they send out their skilled scouts who all go out alone. And Janine said that they take it they're very responsible. She said one scout bee might spend an hour exploring a hollow log as a possible future home. And then all the scout bees come back and they dance what they saw to the community, and the community lines up behind the dance describing the future home that they like best, and then they all go there. I love that. And then you were taking us to the Beehive Collective of Artists.
Yes, beehivecollective.org, an amazing group of artists that travel the country promoting all kinds of great movements and providing awareness and education on problems in the world. And they make these amazing, huge posters you've probably seen. But they sort of formed after the Seattle protests and in the beginning of the what we now call the anti-globalization movement, you know, which quickly died when September 11th happened. And I find it ironic that, you know, not only the Beehive Collective is amazing and they're back on the road, so I would really encourage people to check them out, but how this idea of anti-globalization, which was fresh, top and center on the left's sort of agenda, you know, back at Seattle as a peak, but growing from there, obviously, identifying this sort of corporate global hold on our lives. Now that's kind of disappeared from that side of society, and it's been much more embraced by what we now call, I suppose, the right, which I just see as a fascinating evolution in short time of that particular meme of identifying what our problems are by the globalists.
Right. Well, you spoke about TAZ, temporary autonomous zones, right, pulsing together and then disappearing. Right, pulsing, you know, and Graeber in the Dawn of Everything. Again, I'm going to be reading the whole thing. I'm going to be reading, but this pulse between hierarchy, which gets stuff done, but is, you know, horrifically oppressive and depends on slave labor and everything, you know, into egalitarian, and that's why I was so surprised, you know, I have friends going to Teotihuacan, and I go, let me research Teotihuacan. And having spent a fair amount of time in the Yucatan, and Graeber says how the people of Teotihuacan turned their backs on monument building and human sacrifice and instead embarked on a remarkable project of social housing. And he gives a great history, just a little bit of the thing here. And he says, you know, for the first 300 years, there's evidence of human sacrifice and infant sacrifice at the pyramids and the thing. And he said, you would think at this point, around AD 200, that the fate of Teotihuacan was sealed, its destiny to join the ranks of classic Mesoamerican civilizations with their strong tradition of warrior aristocracy and city-states governed by hereditary nobles. And then he says, no, but that's not what happened. And he says, but the evidence tells us a very different story. All right, we're here to change stories. We're going to honor the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction at 21 degrees of Taurus on April 21st, but all around, you know, it could be a marvelous renaissance of ingenuity and stories and choosing the story, you know, for all of us, like, crossroads, which story are we going to choose, totalitarian annihilation of the earth or egalitarian mutual aid? So he says the citizens of Teotihuacan chose a different path. And he says instead of building palaces and elite quarters, the citizens embarked on a remarkable project of urban renewal, supplying high-quality apartments for all the city's population, regardless of wealth or status. And then he says, what we see after AD 300 is an extraordinary flow of urban resources into the provision of excellent stone-built housing, again, but for the majority of Teotihuacan's population. And it goes on and on and on. It's like, I had no idea of this, that, you know, in the midst of, you know, because the Mayans, exquisite, but very subjugation, you know, and Graeber's always pointing us to look at, you know, tyranny requires subjugation. And how we want to always, you know, be wary of authority, and just random notes. You know, you can guide me back to order. But I love everything I've run across by David Graeber. He says, you know, we're addicted to work. Useless work crowds out useful work. It's useless work that's destroying the planet. It is not our pleasure destroying the world, but industry. That's very fun. Speculative building, empty office buildings, and so on. We go, yes, like that. So, yeah, back to Venus. You know, pleasure is good for us, and leisure, and all of those things, and the capacity. And then just sticking it in, because I love it. I love the phrase, no fortune without a felony. So the accumulation of, it's a wonderful thing. But, yeah, so beauty, nature, Janine Benyus, biomimicry as the sine qua non, many people working on biomimicry economic systems to, you know, that money is like water metaphorically, and you want to slow it down and circulate it slowly through communities, and then be like the bees and be like the, you know, So, yeah, the temporary autonomous zones pulsing together and then disappearing. So it's like stories, 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 and then keeping fluid and flexible, no one story. So it's good for things to appear and then disappear, or hierarchy transitions into egalitarian. Maybe where we are now as a choice, right? I mean, do you root for this, that we can have this choice right before us? Which way do we want to go?
I think we're at that point, and I think it's a cyclical point that we keep coming back to. And you mentioned Teotihuacan down there in the south, but even that entire culture, eventually moved their way up to as far as Wisconsin, where we have this place called Aztlán, which is the last sort of northern remnant of this hierarchical pyramid building, sun worshiping, that kind of culture that you were talking about, sacrifices, etc. But then after that, in the rest of Wisconsin, you see another culture start to form when that disappeared, and that was the effigy mound culture. So instead
Oh,
of
yeah.
building these large square mounds, of power, they're building large complexes of very artistic mounds based on biomimicry. We're going to do eagles, and we're going to have round mounds, but they're not just random. They're tracking the planetary motions and the sun and the moon. And so I think that was one of those dropout cultures, one of the zero work cultures, as we might be able to visualize them now, where instead of this useful work of counting and counting and hoarding and hoarding, they are following their passions, which I think is the way, in my mind at least, to envision how we get out of this trap of useless work, is how can we follow our passions? How can we look ourselves in the mirror and go, are you living your passion? And some of the utopian theorists, especially on the socialist side, like Charles Fourier in France, developed this massive, this massive utopian system all based on passions. He said we would work, and do four or five things a day because we'd, weave the baskets, and then we'd feel like going and harvesting the rice, and then we'd go and help with the cooking and maybe take care of some kids. And that sounds like a really exciting life, as opposed to the drudgery of what we, allow ourselves to live now.
The quote from Fourier I always keep in my pocket is, he says, in any ideal community, we must allow for the positive passion for intrigue. Because when people conspire to do something good, it draws upon more elegant parts of the psyche than daytime. And it's like, that's great, positive intrigue. We're in a time of positive intrigue, team. And I love Richard Farina's quote, goes, take the zircon to Fapa and tell him we move tonight. So positive intrigue, that people want a guiding story. Here's the thing, everybody wants a guiding story. In times of complex disruption and change, it can go, it's very tippy. Right, it can go like, oh, we need a strong man, right, or a strong cuckoo woman. Either way, just a tyrant. We need a tyrant, or no, let's not do that. Back to the equality dynamic. And you mentioned, to tease this into all of the realms, the micro and the macro. You mentioned also the small press distribution, the SPD and their crisis, like. Goddard College just closed. Okay, and back to small press distribution. If you that you said started in 1969, and do you want to just tell us, honor them, and then what's happened and what is before us as an incentive to experiment now?
Well, it's a massive crisis in the small press publishing world. SPD, Small Press Distribution in Berkeley, started in 1969. Peter Howard, who ran Serendipity Books there on University Avenue, it started in the back of that shop, or one of his earlier shops, actually, on Shattuck, I believe. But it was a distribution. They solved the problem, all these little small presses. How do we get it into libraries? How do we get them into bookstores? And they did it for 50 years, and last week they just shut down. We could talk about why they shut down, but you know, mainly funding, bit of a toxic work environment, supposedly. But the point is that there's like 300 small presses now that are in the verge of possibly going under or in a crisis situation where they don't have access to their books. The books were all shipped, and we're talking about 300,000 books these folks held from over 400 small presses, a lot of them not in business anymore. And they sent them to Ingram, this huge distributor, and sent the presses a letter saying, hey, these folks have your books now. You got to pay to get them back. And if you don't, they're going to be pulped. And so, you know, this massive book distributor is saying, we're going to recycle these books. And it seems like the most idiotic, like, stupid thing that we could easily fix if those small presses decided to come together somehow and form a cooperative and, like, deal with their distribution and own it and have equity. There are these models, especially the cooperative models. But I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who have small press connections and or love the small presses. And, you know, this is something I wish could get resolved somehow without, you know, hearing next month that, yeah, a couple hundred thousand books were pulped. And it really signals the death of the ecology of the book, really, in general, from your small town library, friends associations that are no longer around, to the way books are bought and sold, and the fact that most of them end up in the dumpster and in the landfill for just lack of an ecosystem to put them into. The small bookstores, the used bookstores are disappearing, have disappeared. You know, if you want, like, truth and reconciliation and reparations, I think that Amazon should be, you know, paying the book community to, you know, for all the you know, bookstores that have closed because of their works. And so
I didn't want to interrupt you except to say, let's put that on the altar of Against All Odds Desirable Mystery, right? Just see, we just see a little avenue opening up of resources trickling from Amazon. You know, it's like my friend Pat Ewing, when we were doing election magic councils, and we will probably strike those up again, you know. But she said, you know, she was delineating all the dirty money, big guys, you know, funding horrible things. And she said, I like to see him as the Monopoly man with a giant bag of money. And we're just seeing coyotes come up behind him and nipping the bag so that the bag leaks. You know, when he gets there, all the money's gone. And that happened. That one of the most egregious people is like, I don't know where my money went. It just all went away. So this is where we bring in the trickster play, esoteric, against all odds, Granny Weatherwax, million to one chances crop up 9 times out of 10 when your heart is dedicated. You know, try stuff. But yeah, so that's a good image for us all to have. You know, Amazon paying reparations or whatever, again, as you bring up the worthiness of the books. And then, you know, and then also it was this week that Goddard College closed, again, as not financially sustainable and many other possible reasons. But yeah,
and
no, that's why I think...
here, Northland College up in Ashland, that's one of the premier environmental universities around, and they did the same thing. They said, we don't have the money, we're millions of dollars in debt. And you know, this is systemic. How can you make sense of a budget of the national, you know, of the United States that in the last two administrations has doubled, right, from all the previous presidents up until Trump, and then Trump and Biden doubled that number, and it's just exponentially going up. How do you make sense of that and try to, you know, besides just, you know, jubilee, right? Why don't we bring back that concept? That's kind of a good idea about now. Let's just forgive all the debts. You know, we made this system. That's the thing that we have to never forget. These are our rules. They're not God's rules, or they're not anyone else's. The economic system is something we came up with, and we can throw it away and start over if we want, right?
Right. No, absolutely.
Not, but I think we can.
No. Well, we'll come back to Graeber saying, you know, it may or may not happen, but which do you prefer, right? And Ursula Gwynne's great quote, we live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable, but so did the divine right of kings. Oh, right. Right. Yeah. So we're going to have a short musical break. It's my buddy Tim Francik and his buddies also, all the chains came off. But it is an ode to equality and liberation. And, you know, one of the powerful things in the movie Origin, can't recommend it highly enough, about Isabel Wilkerson's writing of the book Caste, The Origins of Our Discontent. And she says, "A world without caste would set everyone free." So here's our music to amplify that. Everybody's chains came off. May it be so. May it be so by the power of the eclipse and our gathering here. This is Caroline Casey, Weaver of Context for the Visionary Activist Show. By the power of our wonderful guest, ally, fellow, anarcho, entheo, animist, enthusiast, Eddie Nix. So, symbiotic mutualism, everybody's chains came off. That's great. You know, when this show started, Visionary Activist Show, 27 and a half years ago, with James Hillman as its first guest. And I do treasure, you know, a very grumpy caller from Berkeley. I'm very happy to hold her dear, who said, you know, why are you talking about this spiritual gobbledygook? The world is owned by imperialists and capitalists. And that's why I created, you know, a category of what I wish I'd said last week. So the next week I said, there are those who appropriately feel that the world is owned by imperialists and capitalists, that we can't afford to have an animistic, spiritual, collaborative practice. We understand that, but we would say the world is owned by imperialists and capitalists, so we can't afford not to have, you know, all of our skills, all of our participatory skills. And, you know, and it may be, you know, with Kropotkin and many, many others, that, you know, what is it to be human aside from our terrible manners? It may be our opportunity, responsibility, opportunity, responsibility, very wedded right now, to borrow qualities of intelligence from the plants and animals with whom we share this planet. So you'd sent me, many wonderful, many treasures that will take years to unpack. That's right. But remembering Peter Lamborn Wilson and just this little quote that he has, sacred lycanthropy. Ah, ye wolves in all your ranging, I have found you kind and true, more than man, and now I'm changing, and will soon be one of you. It's Ojibwe, right? So we love that, right? Exactly. And that's, let me toss it back to you after this, because Isabel Wilkerson, profound cast, the movie Origin, can't recommend it highly enough, crucial part of our thing, that it is essential to subjugate tyranny and to think of a whole class of people, a caste of people, as animals. I've always had a problem with this. I like animals. I think we should be worthy of that, going, they're just animals. It's like, that would be an improvement, right? But again, so it's a double diss, right? It's like, so to be like, the wolves, to be, the wolf model of leadership, as I've spoken of for 27 years, and the wolf and coyote model, wouldn't it be great? They're mating now as an evolutionary asset in this time of where we've disrupted everything, because wolves, they play every 30 minutes, no matter what. That's important. But they have a very responsible community structure. Everybody's got a responsible job, to breed. Others take care. Others are scouts. Coyotes, not so much. Mad anarchist geniuses. And so I love the model that I say to myself as a soothing, wouldn't it be great to belong to and contribute to a supportive wolf pack that encouraged all of our mad coyote genius? And it's like, oh yes, like that. Because groups
Well, I was just going to say, we have them and they're called teenagers. which brings up the idea of the school, which I wanted to touch on.
Yes.
And Steiner as one of these radical characters who embraced both the spiritual and the radical, self-described anarchist, but going on to, work much more in the spiritual realm, and created this Waldorf system, which all kinds of people have jumped onto, including the gang here in Viroqua. And when we started this high school back in 1996, it was based on Waldorf, but we didn't want to be a Waldorf school because they all seemed to be kind of trending towards, prep schools for, the elite kind of kids in different places. And there was no real homesteading kind of Waldorf scene apart from Viroqua. So we created it as kind of an anarchist free school, but kind of Waldorf inspired, I guess. And the main focus was, in my mind at least, and I've tried to, encourage this year after year, is for the kids to actually have control of the school. Like, this is your school. You create the rules. You create, and give them that responsibility. Because once that narrative changes of, oh, I'm in another oppressive situation, just like life. And that can be a real downer, obviously. And it's true in a lot of senses. So if you reverse that, you have the potential. It doesn't always work. Certain classes are there to get through it. But others go, okay, we're going to grab onto this. And they start acting like wolf packs, I'll tell you. The beauty of kids at that age kind of being free to explore and create their own education is one of the things I think we've really, really lost in this culture. And I think it comes back to Kropotkin, honestly, and his ideas of is everything selfish, really? And the selfish gene idea that's come out of it. Or are we a little more altruistic than that? And I think that when you give, especially, humans at that age, some of their own agency, remarkable things can happen.
Right. I was at that school when I had the great trip to Viroqua last autumnal equinox, and it was remarkable in many, many cool ways. There were all these teens looking kind of like, just like teens. But then the encouragement, the invitation, was for everybody to give a blessing, And everybody gave beautiful blessings, appreciation of the beauty of their parents and how much they loved the friends and how much they loved the school. And it was remarkable that, you know, I heard this great TED talk on cannabis, and somebody kind of grumpy said, well, why do people laugh when they smoke weed, you know, or cannabis? And the speaker said, no, it's not the cannabis that makes people laugh. We are a laughing species. It just relaxes the conditioned inhibition. And I go, I love that. Because we could then say, like with the kids in Viroqua that you're teaching, or vice versa, that, you know, blessing is intrinsic. May it go well for you and for you. You know, we're just relaxing. We're deconditioning and relaxing the stresses. And the whole history, it takes us back to Kropotkin and how people were so outraged that they spent, you know, all this time going, oh no, survival of the fittest and everything. It's kind of like the story of almost Pope Valentinius. I get from Pat Ewing. The reason we have Valentine's Day, it's after almost Pope Valentinius, who was a great heretic. We love heretics, and he was like, what is this silly con of original sin? That's silly. And what is this non-equality? No. We're going to have men and women serving priesthoods. But more than that, nobody stays in one post. One week you're part of the parish, then you're part of the clergy, then you rotate around again, you know. And he was almost pope, right? We almost had a holiday celebrating equality. But then the Christian fathers spent the next like 500 years refuting him and going way over, and everyone knows that women have no soul. I mean, they put all that out there. So almost, right? These times of like almost. And I was thinking about almost with the eclipse, because people saying, oh yeah, I think I was in an eclipse. It's like, no. Almost an eclipse, nothing compared to total, right? That almost thing. And for many of us, I include myself, you know, we want to eclipse or compost the almost, like I almost did that thing, or I almost did that thing. Between almost and doing, between almost an eclipse is a world. It's like, whoa. So yeah, so the almost thing. So you're teaching at the school, and also in Viroqua, I met people running grade schools where all the classes were outdoors, even in winter. I'm like, okay, I could have, yeah, that would be rough, but I could do that. It's what I wanted as a young rebellious teen. I wanted what you're suggesting, right? I would go to these fancy, you know, where I was temporarily housed at you know, fancy prep schools, going, this is not education, this is privileged nonsense, whatever. But I yearned for what you're describing, and that experiment is going well at the high school, you think?
It is. It's grown, you know, to the point where we kind of have to stop bringing in students, and kids have come from all over the country and from really all over the world. There's usually about 20%, maybe 10 to 20% of the kids are from other countries. So people find out about the school, and it's, you know, it's because of the rural sort of homesteady, back to the landy area around here, where, you know, you're getting people from the coasts, and you know, and it's a shame there's not more of these places that you know, because it's not, the whole community is not about Waldorf by any means, but it's a major factor in why a lot of people chose to move here. And this new school you were talking about, it's called the Forest School, and it's out in a wilderness preserve, about 20 miles outside of town. And yeah, they started out with like first and second graders, and they're literally outdoors almost all day in the, you know, and you talk about animism. I mean, animism is, you know, Latin is breath and spirit and life, right? I mean, it's everything has some sort of distinct spiritual essence. And if you can teach that at such a young age, and kids are outside, I mean, these kids know more plants than I do, you know, at second, third grade, because they care about it, and everything's a discovery, a journey of discovery. You know, it's a little harder with high school, of course, because that element gets diminished by that time, and changes are happening. And but I think it is, the land is always the key to these movements, right? And we've talked about that backstage a little bit. You know, but here we are again with the cartography. Where's the cartography of autonomy, right? Everything's mapped. Where's that space for us to have this sort of new incarnation of community? It's becoming more and more problematic. But I think, yes.
No, it's we're at a very, very tippy point. You know, again, tyranny or let's try democracy, let's try mutual aid. You know, and you know, the dehumanization. I mean, again, Isabel Wilkerson and everybody going right. So America had to dehumanize blacks and dehumanize Native Americans, and then she delineates, and it's in the film, you know, that the Nazi generals gathered around, and there's she finds a picture of them at a meeting, and then she researches the archives and finds the minutes of that meeting, and they're like, well, look at what America did. Okay, we could do that. So first you have to, you know, prevent, you know, intermarriage, you know, and then you have to dehumanize, then you have to get everybody to think of them as, you know, the scapegoat, the shame, then you have to do that, you know, and again, this is so pertinent, you know, it's the dehumanization of Palestinians by dehumanizing, and many people have said, you know, Israel and Germany, the media is sterilized, and America, media is sterilized, open eyes and assume responsibility. You know, and just, you know, we got to keep on top of it. You know, Bisan, whom I follow, love her, and we'll get to everything. We'll get to cutting off the screen, but using the screen usefully. So I love Bisan. You know, so today, you know, an orphanage was bombed in Khan Yunus, right? An orphanage, right? And the graveyard for orphan children was bulldozed. And so everywhere, wafting in the ruins, are these letters of love from orphan children to their future adoptive parents going, thank you so much. And it's like, you know, but the media being sterilized, and this is part of the books being, you know, pulped and everything going, it is incumbent upon all of us to be as informed as possible. No one source, no one story, nuance, complexity, you know, which takes us also into the whole realm of conspiracies, wherever we want to go with that. Let me just put a little more of what we know, what we can feel. You know, Isabel Wilkerson says, you know, caste is just one group above another group, and she was ardent to lift this conversation out of race because she said that was a bamboozlement. You know, she said, she asks a friend in the film, but also in real life, you know, are Jews white? And they go, well, most of them. Germans are white. So it's not race. You know, in India, the untouchable, what used to be called the untouchables, the Dalits, you know, all Indian, all same race, right? So she goes, it's deeper than that. We want to go for the deep, and it requires, the bottom of it, you have to have a hierarchy and have people at the bottom to blame and to have grievance, and it makes me think also that where we're scanning for those liberating qualities in culture and in mythology, when I got back from India, where I'd been teaching some years back, and I go, there's something really missing. And a friend welcomed me back and said he had been, you know, his whole life is dedicated to Rudra and the Rudra chants. You can find them on YouTube. They're very impressive. And he goes, Rudra was the disruptive trickster champion of egalitarianism against caste, like almost Pope Valentinius. What is this ridiculous concept of caste? And it's like, I knew it underneath. And the mythological overlords hired Shiva. We think of Shiva as a kind of cool, wild guy. No, Shiva's name means to quiet. So Shiva was stuck on top of Rudra. You just quiet down with your talk of equality. You just shush right up there, right? And we go, oh. So I think this time, this eclipse, this Jupiter, this whatever, however you want to feel it or narrate it too, is a time of all the liberating, all that's been suppressed that's liberating, coming on back. You know, everybody's chains came off, right? So as kind of part of that dynamic. And Isabel Wilkerson, you know, talks deeply about this. There's also an amazing movie, Bandit Queen, The Tale of Phulan Devi. That's a whole other thing. We'll have to come back and talk about everything. But an amazing movie, true, about a Dalit, untouchable woman who wreaks her revenge by being a very successful bandit and then negotiates her surrender, equal rights in schooling and things for her people. Anyway, so there's that over there. So, yes, and then shall we go to wherever you want to go, Eddie Nix, to conspiracies? Shall we go to conspiracies?
Well, it what you were saying about Gaza, I think, reminds me of a story that Bob, Robert Anton Wilson, used to tell about Ouspensky, another prince who, became quite the radical in his own way. And this is when he was in World War One and he was on the front lines and he was seeing all these artificial legs come up and he saw the shipment of them. And then the next week there was another shipment of artificial legs and he knew that this was planned. I mean, that this was a certainty that if this continued, that this many legs would be needed and this many people would die. And to him, it was the horror of the situation. And I think, in this time of that transition you speak of, I think our eyes need to be opened and we need to wake up. And that happens to different people in different ways. But I think sometimes seeing the horror of the situation is one of the best, quickest ways to liberate that sort of veil. And I think it brings up, like you were saying about the Nazis, how they modeled their program on our program with the Native Americans. And we also went out of our way to bring back Operation Paperclip, CIA, many of these Nazi scientists across the realm, including like Werner von Braun, who, head of NASA during our glorious moon adventures. From bioterror to, it's an ugly story, but I think the more we learn, and I think that's the beauty, if there is any beauty in what you call conspiracies, because that is diving deep. That is sort of looking into these things that we're not really supposed to look into, or there's another narrative. And I think it can really open people's eyes. There's a big problem, though, because there's so much sort of around that floating in the jetsam and the flotsam, right? That is the threads of disinformation, the threads of, paid trolls or whoever it is. So to detangle can become insane. And I see this with young people where, I brought up the fact that the great physicist Higgs died during during the eclipse. He who had posited the Higgs particle, which, is kind of back to Sheldrake, the morphogenic field. What is it that holds all this together? Is there the possibility that, through the stuff that we call ether or call, whatever, the great goo, that things can be transmitted without being there? All these sort of ideas that have been posited throughout time, he, as a physicist, came up with this idea, and then they figured it out that, hey, yeah, there is all this stuff, and he had it right. But quantum mechanics itself is one of those disrupting ideologies that really throws the world into a maybe. And that's where it comes back to Robert Anton Wilson, a great, champion of conspiracy theories, at least looking into him, and his idea of maybe logic, where there is no certainty. No matter where you look, you're not going to find certainty. It's all grades of maybe, okay? And the sooner we can get away from using the word is and to be, the sooner we get liberated from this certainty that clouds all our understandings. You are evil. Hamas is evil. It's like, no, they acted evil on this day here, and let's look at the rest of the story. Or Israel's evil. Well, no, there's some generals. Right. And so getting past this is, I think, is one of the best ways to liberate ourselves from the chasm of doubt and uncertainty, because we realize that it is uncertain. We don't know. It is chaos. People, the anarchists forever have been saying, oh, anarchy is not chaos. Well, nature is chaos. OK. And if we're going back to, if we're yearning for a more natural state, that's going to be more chaos. Now, is chaos bad? Not necessarily, follow these subatomic particles around. They don't make sense, but they make sense. We can't see the sense in it.
Right. Well, we'd have to really define chaos, wouldn't? I mean, chaos, wouldn't we? One of the two words we get from Mayan is hurricane, and shark. But hurricane was the original god of chaos, the originating back into the cauldron from which we ladle out, kind of like an eclipse, from which we ladle out the desirable. So not a bad thing at all. And then what you say about certainty, it's a Neptune thing. There is no certainty. There never was, but now there really is none. I mean, some things are true, but there are times when they're truer. Like right now, certainty's always been a booby prize, but now there is no certainty. And the astro-animism would say, good, you humans. You know, you used to have a lot of opinions. Now you're available to mystery. I wonder what the most wonderful thing we could do now. I wonder what this would be. Now we're back into the call and response, you know, humbled. You know, our word human comes from humus, dirt, from which we get, you know, humble. We're meant to be humble people in the dirt, right? Humble beings in the dirt, you know, and available going, yeah, flummoxed. There must be a larger guiding thing. But, yeah, and then just the realm of conspiracy. Yes, we love conspiracy, tracking things. But this is why education, you know, everything can be liberating or imprisoning, including conspiracies. It's a Saturn-Uranus thing. Freedom comes from dedication and doing the work. You know, so to really track a conspiracy, it requires, you know, diligence. And that's why I was sort of bemoaning the easy, facile, and we can get to cell phones and stuff. I think, oh no, we're almost out of time. Oh well, this is part one. Thank goodness. But so the lazy conspiracy, when the ship crashed into the bridge in Baltimore, people were like, oh well, Biden did it or the Chinese did it. And it's like, no, it was infrastructure. It was predictable, but infrastructure. Do not let us not hire conspiracy to abdicate responsibility for participating in the world in a better way. We are on our way out. But let me give you the last wish or blessing or woofiness about equality to you, Eddie Nix.
Well, hopefully equality, you know, is what we're going to manifest here with this little bit of radio magic. And I think you're the only person doing live radio magic in the country. So once again, it's totally an honor to be here. And like my buddy Earl Fontanelle over at the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast said, stay esoteric, Caroline.
That's all of us. I wouldn't say I'm the only one, because that'll attract many people with pitchforks. We go, no, maybe we all be doing our radio magic, and especially our wonderful board op, Kirsten Thomas. And thank you so much, Eddie Nix. It's Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Oh, yeah.